महिमः भागवतः शशाशः यथा हि सुत्याम अभिजात कोविदः समादिशन् विप्रमः गुणस्तथा सूत उवाच ततः परीक्षित द्विजवर्य शिक्षया महिम महाभागवत शशाशः यथा हि सुत्याम अभिजात कोविदः समादिशन् विप्रमः गुणस्तथा सूत उवाच ततः परीक्षित द्विजवर्य शिक्षया महिम महाभागवत शशाशः यथा हि सुत्याम अभिजात कोविदः समादिशन् विप्रमः गुणस्तथा ततः परीक्षे द्विजवर्य शिक्षया महाभागवत शशाशः हि सुत्याम् अभिजात कोविदः समादिशन् विप्रमहद्गुणस्तथा वैष्णवीस् सूत उवाच सः परीक्षे द्विजवर्य शिक्षया हि महाभागवत शशाशः हि सुत्याम् अभिजात कोविदा समादिशान् विप्रमः गुणस्तथा सूत उवाच सूत गोस्वामी सेड ततः देर आफ्टर परीक्षित महाराज परीक्षित विजवर्य द ग्रेट ट्वाइस बोर्न ब्राह्मणास शिक्षया by their instructions mahim the earth mahabhagavatah the great devotee shashash ruled her in the past yatha as they told it he certainly Sutyam, at the time of his birth, Abhijata Kovidaha, expert astrologers at the time of birth, Samadishan gave their opinions, Vipra, O Brahmanas, Mahadgunaha, Great qualities. Tatha. True to that. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, Swami Srila Prabhupada. Sutta Goswami said, O learned Brahmanas, Maharaj Parikshit then began to rule over the world as a great devotee of the Lord, under the instructions of the best of the twice-born Brahmanas. He ruled by those great qualities which were foretold by expert astrologers at the time of his birth. At the time of Maharaj Parikshit's birth, the expert astrologer Brahmanas foretold some of his qualities. Maharaj Parikshit developed all these those qualities, being a great devotee of the Lord. The real qualification is to become a devotee of the Lord, and gradually all the good qualities worthy of possession developed. Maharaj Parikshit was a Mahabhagavata, a first-class devotee, who was not only well-versed in the science of devotion, but also able to convert others to become devotees by his transcendental instructions. Maharaj Parikshit was therefore a devotee of the first order, and thus he used to consult great sages and learned Brahmanas, who could advise him by the Shastras how to execute the state administration. Such great kings were more responsible than modern elected executive heads, because they obliged the great authorities by following their instructions left in Vedic literatures. There was no need for impractical fools to enact daily a new legislative bill and to conveniently alter it again and again to serve some purpose. The rules and regulations were already set forth by great sages like Manu, Yajnavalkya, Parashar and other liberated sages. And the enactments were all suitable for all ages in all places. Therefore, the rules and regulations were standard and without flaw or defect. Kings like Maharaj Parikshit had their council of advisors, and all the members of that Brahmanas of that council were either great sages or Brahmanas of the first order. They did not accept any salary, nor had they any necessity for such salaries. The state would get the best advice without expenditure. They were themselves Samadarshi, equal to everyone, both man and animal. They would not advise the king to give protection to man and instruct him to kill the poor animals. Such council members were not fools or representatives to compose a fool's paradise. They were all self-realized souls, and they knew perfectly well how all living beings in the state would be happy, both in this life and in the next. They were not concerned with the hedonistic philosophy of eat, drink, be merry and enjoy. They were philosophers in the real sense, and they knew well what is the mission of human life. Under all these obligations, the advisory council of the king would give correct instructions, and the king or the executive head, being himself a qualified devotee of the Lord, would scrutinizingly follow them for the welfare of the world, of the state. The state in the days of Maharaj Yudhishthira Maharaj Parikshit was a welfare state in the real sense of the term, because no one was unhappy in that state, be he man or animal. Maharaj Parikshit was an ideal king for a welfare state of the world. Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjanishalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Itinamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatyadeshatarine Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindhubhyayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So I'm grateful to be here with all of you today, and I'll speak today on the topic of how Brahmanas can guide the state today. So here the pastime is that Parikshit Maharaj, his life story is being described. And what is described is that he was the exemplary ruler, that he manifested the qualities that were predicted at his birth, and then he led the kingdom expertly. And the key principle here is said that is that he was Abhijata Kovidaha. He was guided by Brahmana, by the sages, Brahmana and the sages. So let's look at this from three broad points. So I'll talk about these three points. The first is the principle of Brahman Kshatriya cooperation. How the two can work together. A lot of fascinating insights are given in the Dharma Shastras. And then we'll talk about recent examples and challenges of how something similar has been implemented and how it has sometimes fired and sometimes backfired. And then we will discuss doable actions right now. What can we, as those who are students and teachers in Krishna consciousness, do to help raise the consciousness of the world? So this principle that the Brahmanas are meant to guide the Kshatriyas, this is a repeated theme in scripture. Now, how does this work in practical life? There is a saying in English that good fences make good neighbors. If there is no clear fence, is this my property or your property? And that can become a huge problem. So before Brahmanas and Kshatriyas can cooperate, there has to be a clear understanding of the boundaries. What are the roles of a Brahmana and what are the roles of a Kshatriya? So let's try to understand this first. There are broadly, now these, as we know, Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, these are decided based more on disposition and occupation. They are not decided based on birth. So what is the nature of the person and what is the kind of work that they best do? So we have Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Shudras. Now, the size is not reflective of the importance over here. I'm talking about, this is going to be the focus of our discussion, the Brahmanas and Kshatriyas. That's why they're depicted somewhat larger over here. Every limb of society is important. In that you can say it's indispensable. And that's why, sometimes these four varnas are called as a hierarchy. But what is also equally important to understand, that their interaction is not just a hierarchy. Rather, it is not so much a hierarchy as it is a synergy. The hierarchical aspect is important in its own way. But sometimes when that alone is emphasized, then the problem comes that it all becomes primarily a power struggle. You know, are you respecting me or not? Are you obeying me or not? But the point is not so much hierarchy as synergy. That everybody can be engaged appropriately according to their natures and according to their social roles. So the synergy aspect is also very important to understand. And what this means is that there are different specializations. And one who is a specialist in a particular field should be allowed the freedom to work in that field with that specialization. So, with respect to this, when we differentiate between hierarchy and synergy, the idea is, Krishna says, with swakarmanatam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manava. That swakarmana, through your work, you can worship that Lord and you can attain that Lord. So when there is a material vision that is emphasized, then the focus goes too much on hierarchy. I am higher than you, how dare you not obey me? You should be listening to me. But when there is a spiritual vision, the focus goes more on service, on contribution. And that's how we can have synergy. And the Bhagavad Gita, while it talks about the system of Varanas, its focus ultimately is devotional. And that's why there can be the synergy over there. Now, why is the hierarchy sometimes emphasized and why the synergy need to be emphasized? See, while these four Varanas, we can see them in this way. But they can also be seen in this way. So the important thing is that it is a principle to recognize that no varna is beyond Maya. What is the meaning of this? No Varana is beyond Maya? That everyone being in the material world is fallible. Everyone is corruptible. So, when there is too much emphasis on hierarchy, now is it that some of the Varanas, there are greater conditionings and there are greater vulnerability of Maya? Yes, that is true. That's why past karma. But everyone is vulnerable to Maya. And that's why if any Varana is given absolute authority, that means, as we know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So in the Indian tradition, what happened? Srila Prabhupada also said that. He said one of his concerns was that his followers were not sufficiently afraid of Maya. So similarly, when the hierarchy is more emphasized, the Brahmana start thinking, we are pure and all of you are attached. Well, the pride of purity is itself an impurity. Isn't it? The pride of purity is itself an impurity. And this, in one sense, that no Varana is beyond Maya, this is actually a very democratic insight. If you want to use a contemporary political philosophy word, that actually all Varanas are equal because everyone is corruptible. And that's why absolute power cannot be vested in any Varana. Now we could say that those who are more in contact with material nature, they are more likely to be corruptible. But it's not that simple. That actually it is more due to inner conditionings than outer conditions. Both are important. So with this broad understanding that if the hierarchy is emphasized too much, then the Bhagavatam is full of examples of those who are at the top of the hierarchy. The Brahmanas doing short-sighted things, getting angry, getting corrupted. Now, we see that the corruption is not so much in the greed for wealth as it is for prestige and power. How dare you disrespect me? The Durvasa Muni, it's not even a disrespect. You know, if a guest has come to our house, if we take a little water before giving the guest, how big a disrespect is that? Maybe in traditional culture, it's a disrespect. But to want to attack somebody because of that. So everyone is corruptible. And that's why everybody has to have a say in how things work. Now, we may sometimes, I'll talk about this a little later, we may sometimes quote Prabhupada and say democracy is not the right thing. Okay. Now what happens is there are some sound bites in Prabhupada's teachings which get transmitted very easily. But whether those sound bites actually reflect Prabhupada's overall presentation is open to question. So Prabhupada sometimes is quoted to us that Prabhupada said democracy is demon crazy. Well, yeah, he did say that. But his point was something very significant. That his point was, before we go into contemporary application, if you see these four Varanas, how do they work together? Broadly, when the Brahmanas giving advice to Kshatriyas, if you consider the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas. So, what are the do's and the don'ts? You know, every cooperation requires boundaries. And once the fences are clear, then there can be cooperation. So, first thing is, the Brahmanas are not Kshatriyas. That means the Brahmanas shouldn't presume that we can do the role of Kshatriyas. That we know everything about how to manage things. Actually, real world management is extremely complicated. And so Brahmanas are not equal to Kshatriyas. So just as it is by Krishna's arrangement that everybody has been given certain abilities. So the domain of ideas is the domain of Brahmanas. The domain of resources, the domain of governance is the domain of Kshatriyas. So Brahmanas cannot presume that no Kshatriya expert is required. So just because some Brahmanas know scripture doesn't mean that they can override constantly the domain of the Kshatriyas. The Kshatriyas themselves need their space, their independence. Secondly, I said Brahmanas are not Kshatriyas. Now does that mean that somebody who is a Brahmana, well, somebody may be Brahmana by birth, somebody may be a renunciate, can they play Kshatriya roles? Yeah, in emergencies it may happen. But the point is the two Varanas are different. Sometimes one occupation, apad dharma, might happen. But in general, Brahmanas give guidance. And the guidance is more in terms of principles. And in the past, there were two kinds of Kshatriyas. Sorry, two kinds of Brahmanas. These are called the city sages and the forest sages. So, the city sages, they are the, like the Rajapurohit or the Rajaguru. They are the general part of the Brahminical council. And the forest sages, they are, you could say, distant advisors. And both of them had different roles. We may say that the Brahmanas are supposed to be independent. But the fact is, the king has a lot of power. And if you consider the Brahman-Kshatriya dynamic, we could look at these two broad as a pendulum, and then we find the balance. See, those who are living in the cities, city Brahmanas, what is there? They are very much dependent on Kshatriyas. See, we may say that the Brahmanas wouldn't take salary. Well, yes, but if there is no salary, there is charity. And we may say charity is independent, salary is dependent, but real life is messy. That actually you can say in charity there is greater dependence in some sense. Because salary at least there is a sense of obligation. I have done this, you have to give me this. But charity there is no obligation. So if the Brahmanas give some advice which angers the king, then the king can make the Brahmanas' life hellish. The king can actually persecute the Brahmanas' family. Most of the Brahmanas were grihasthas. They had to maintain them. As not only on the negative side, because the Brahmanas would, these city dwellers, city dwelling Brahmanas, they would be in touch with the, what you can call as the real world. So, they knew about ground level concerns. And that is why their advice was more practical. So when the king had some immediate concerns, so the city dwelling Brahmanas were good for immediate concerns. Okay, I have to make this decision. What should I do? You consult the Brahmanas and they would give some broad advice. So they were in that sense practical. However, there is a flip side to it. The practical is positive. But because they are too close to the center of power, and they will be affected by the changes in the power, they can become, in the name of being, they can become docile. Docile means what? The Kshatriya decides something, and then after that, the Kshatriya tells the Brahmana, okay, you find some Shastra, you find some reasoning to justify what I am trying to do. So, now this is not always a bad thing. You know, we are implementing this policy, now find something in Prabhupada's book to support this policy. Now, is that a bad thing? No, not necessarily, because Srila Prabhupada has given a wide variety of instructions. And those who are in management may not necessarily have read all the instructions. Krishna can also be inspiration from within. But the point is that the Brahmanas who are within the cities, they are much more controllable. So the king knew that if there are major decisions, there are long-term concerns to be considered, major policy decisions to be made. So, for these long-term concerns, there were the forest sages. So, long-term concerns, because what has happened is, these forest sages were relatively more independent. They would live in the forest, they would live on the produce of the forest, fruits and shoots and barks and things like that. And they would be far away from the king. Of course, the king wants, they can persecute. But they are not immediately affected by the king's actions. So they were relatively independent. And that's why the king, when they had to make hard decisions, big decisions, they knew that if there's something unpalatable I might need to hear, they would actually travel from the city to the forest to take advice from these sages. Now, this is that they were independent was positive. But because they were so far away from the sages, they were often not aware of the ground realities. And that's why sometimes their advice could be irrelevant. It could be irrelevant. you tell people to do something, and okay, in the real world, this doesn't work. This doesn't work in the real world. We'll talk about examples of how this has happened in the past. So, the point is that ultimately, it is the king who was the decision maker. The Brahmanas were advisors. And the king would find the appropriate balance and take inputs from both. The king's authority was not to be usurped by the Brahmanas. So, the king is the decision maker. So the king's domain is there, the Brahmanas' domain is there. And different Brahmanas play different roles in giving guidance. Now, when this happens, generally speaking, as I said, the first caution is the Brahmanas don't take the role of the Kshatriyas. The Brahmanas don't think that they are the specialist. The Brahmanas don't micro-control. Kshatriya can, what to speak of micro-control? Kshatriya, Krishna says, Ishwara Bhav. Now, Ishwara Bhav, there are two things over here in the Bhagavad Gita, when you talk about Kshatriya qualities. Krishna says in 1843 that one of their qualities, Ishwara Bhav. Now, Ishwara Bhav literally translates as the mood of the controller. Now, Krishna talks about the demons, and there he talks about, in the 16th chapter, 14-15 verses, he says, Ishwaro aham aham bhogi, siddho aham balwan sukhi. So to think I am the Ishwara is a demoniac quality. So what is going on over here? Is thinking that I am a controller a demoniac quality? Or is it a commended quality of a Kshatriya? Well, there are two things over here. The first is that there is an acknowledgement that God Krishna is the supreme controller. That is definitely true. But at the same time, acknowledging God as a supreme controller is not enough. Somebody has to control things in the world. The principle of entropy, which is talked about in physics, applies to human affairs also. Sakale neha mahata, yogo nashta parantapa. If things are not kept in order, then there will be disorder. So somebody has to control things in the world. There are maybe different kshatriyas with different zones. So somebody has to be the controller here. And some people naturally have that, both the mentality and the ability to control. That means if 10 people are working as a team, okay, you do this, we do this, I'll do this, we take care of this and we work together. So working as a team requires some kind of leader. And there are some people who are good at that. So it is, when does it become demoniac? The Ishwara Bhav, this capacity is a good quality. But the key thing is, the Kshatriyas understand that they are taking this role in a mood of service. The Lord is a supreme controller and we are controllers in His service. But the Ishwara Bhava, the Ishwaroham Ambhogi comes when there is no other controller. The key verse over there is not Ishwaroham Ambhogi. Ko anyo asti sadrusho maya. Who else is there like me? I am the number one. I am the greatest. I am God. That was not the illusion that the Kshatriyas had. So they have to have control. The Ishwara Bhava is an integral characteristic of the Kshatriyas. And the Kshatriya-Brahmana relationships can be soured, spoiled in many ways. And one of them is, if the Brahmanas try to micro-control the Kshatriyas, it's not going to work. But the Brahmanas can go to the other extreme. So what is the role of the Brahmanas in terms of giving guidance to the Kshatriyas? If you can say the Brahmanas to be here, Kshatriyas to be here. So what exactly is the input that they are giving? There are broadly two things. Isn't that there is overall the purpose of life? That what is ultimately life and governance meant for? That repeated reminder that the Brahmanas are supposed to give. Because Kshatriyas are so connected with immediate concerns, and they have to work for the immediate concerns. And most immediate concerns are material concerns. Oh, there's a flood over here, there's a drought over here, there is this over there, there's that over there. So they have to deal with their major concerns, but they need to be reminded of the ultimate concerns repeatedly. Yes, you are doing this management, but there is a purpose of the management. And the purpose is not just material well-being. So it is material plus spiritual well-being. So especially the spiritual part, that is what is important. And apart from that, there could be specific ethical issues. I'll talk about the specific ethical issues a little later. That there are some issues that the Brahmanas may specifically guide. You know, this is right, this is wrong. We have to regulate it. If we don't, there'll be problems. So this is, broadly speaking, the way Brahmanas and Kshatriyas would work together. And the Brahmanas would, the Kshatriyas would recognize that the Brahmanas will remind me of the ultimate priorities, the ultimate purpose. And they will also have a strong thing to say on specific issues. And the Kshatriya Brahmanas will also remember that they are specialists. They are the experts in this field. I cannot micro-control them. So in this way, there was, in principle, the cooperation between the Brahmana Kshatriyas with both the forest sages and the city sages. So now, this principle, how has it been applied or misapplied in recent history? So if we consider, especially, I'll talk about the history of Europe, and then I'll talk about the history of India and see some differences. Now, in the modern times, there is this whole principle of secularism. Secularism is basically the separation of state and religion. And how did it emerge? Basically, as far as most history is written from the Western perspective. And from that perspective, they say that the discovery of America, the discovery of India, XYZ discovered. Well, there are millions of people living over here before you discovered it. It's a very Eurocentric view of the world. But the point was, there, originally there was one religion. The Catholic religion was there. The Christian, which was primarily the Catholic Church. It was in Europe. So Europe shaped the world's world, not just politically, but in a significant way, intellectually. So there, what happened was, the Catholic Church was ruling. So in some ways, you could say the Pope and the priests were like Brahmanas. Not exactly, there's some problems. But what happened was, in many ways, the priests, especially the Pope, took the role of being like not just the head of a spiritual organization, religious organization, but like a super king. And the Pope would often intervene in political affairs to determine who would become the king and who would not become the king. So the Pope was like a super state. And when there was a theological break in the church, between the church was one thing, it broke into two. There were Catholics who followed the church, and then there were the Protestants, they refused to follow the Pope. So now, there are religious reasons for this, but politically what happened was, when Protestants started becoming influential, many of the kings there started using Protestant religion as their excuse for rejecting the authority of the church. So, yeah, anyway, the church is not following the Bible, so why should we listen to you? And that's how Protestantism repeatedly split. Now, there is German Protestantism, there is Anglican Protestantism, there are different Protestants. So each of them had their own branches. And again, first the Catholic Church was like the super state. So the religion was controlling the state. But then what happened was, in England, there was one king who wanted to divorce his wife and he wanted to marry someone else. The Catholic Church does not allow divorce. So what he did is, he divorced from Catholicism itself. So he adapted Protestantism, and so he could divorce his wife, and then the Anglican religion came on. So again, the church and the state was very widely wedded together, very tightly wedded together. And then there was what in the history is called a 100-year war. Now we hear of World War I, World War II, but as the Protestant and Catholics, they were constantly fighting. And finally they decided
Okay, my state has this religion, my state has this religion. How do we avoid this fighting? And that's how they decided that the state, I'm very simplifying a complex history. They said that the state should not tell people how to live, what to believe and how to practice their religion. So in one sense, historically, secularism was an expression of political humility. What do I mean by political humility? That the political heads of state are not meant to tell people what to believe. And in many ways, it is after secularism was adopted that people from different faiths have been able to live together without being constantly at each other's necks. Now, in the Vedic tradition, if you see, this idea of there are two different things which are not to be conflated. So the word religion, as it is used in the West, now what does it convey? Sometimes it is translated as dharma. But that is a very simplistic translation. So actually what we had in the Vedic tradition was, there was dharma and there is bhakti. So dharma, bhakti refers more to devotion. Bhakti, dharma refers more to morality or ethics rather than religion. Now religion and ethics were well together, integrated in many ways. But still, Krishna descends dharma samsthapanarthaya, not bhakti samsthapanarthaya. Because if you see the Kurukshetra war that happened, that was a dharma yuddha. That was not a bhakti yuddha. What do I mean by this? If you consider the Pandavas here, the Kauravas here, it was not that all the Pandavas were bhaktas and the Kauravas were abhaktas. Not like that. Or rather, Pandavas were Krishna bhaktas and the Kauravas were Krishna bhaktas. Among the Pandavas, Drupada was a Shaivite. That was his state, that was his Kuladharma. Kuladaivat was Lord Shiva. And he would worship Lord Shiva. Among the Kauravas, Bhishma was a Vaishnava. Similarly, Bhurishrava was a Vaishnava. So this was not a war to impose a particular kind of religious faith on people. It is not that when Yudhishthira Maharaj performed the Rajasuya Yajna, all the kings under him were told, all of you have to practice Krishna Bhakti only. No, all of you have to practice basic principles of morality. So dharma was implemented by the state. Bhakti was not. Bhakti is a matter of individual choice. No. Now you can say, so dharma in this context, when Krishna said dharma samsthapanarthaya, it is not even morality. It is more law and order. I'll talk about the difference between those quick in a few minutes. But when Krishna is coming, what is it? Dushkrita, vinashaya dushkrita. That he is those who are breaking the law. That's why in the first chapter, if you see the offenses committed by the Kauravas that I described, they are all legal crimes. They are not devotional offenses. That they are to be punished because they tried to dishonor Draupadi. They are to be punished because they tried to burn somebody alive. They are to be punished because they tried to steal someone else's property. So these are all crimes. So we could say that dharma here, it's even more than that, it is law and order. So the problem of secularism, or the problem that secularism solved in the West, was not there in India so much. Because there was this understanding of difference between dharma and bhakti. And dharma was generally supported, established by the state in terms of law and order. But bhakti, the king may have their own preference, their own choice. When Yudhishthira Maharaj expresses devotion to Krishna by having him, having the Agra Puja being performed for him, that example was inspiring for many citizens. Not just his kingdom, other kingdoms. But that did not mean everybody has to worship Krishna. So, that problem of secularism was not there in India. Because India was, in India there was, harmony without homogeneity. Homogeneity means everybody has to be exactly the similar. Harmony means that different people living differently and they live their way, they live homogeneously. They live harmoniously. So for example, just to give a couple, many examples, but in general, when one king would conquer another king, that king would not annex the kingdom. When Lord Ram conquered Lanka, he did not make Lanka part of Ayodhya. He appointed a local person who was dharmic. So Ravan was adharmic and he appointed Vibhishan. Even when Jarasandh was killed, at that time Jarasandh's son was appointed as the king. When Bhishma was seeking some princes for Pandu and Dhritarashtra, so he went to the kingdom of Madri. And there, when he went there, at that time, Shalva, who was the brother of Madri, he said that in our kingdom, in our area, our kingdom, the tradition is that we don't give dowry, rather we receive a bride price. That means that the boy's family gives a gift to the girl's family. And Bhishma said, yeah, I know about this already. That's why I have brought a generous set of gifts for you. Now, of course, he also gave some gifts to Bhishma. That's just an expression of affection. But there was this cultural diversity. But what happened was, now in some ways, when Islamic rule was there in India, Muslims often destroyed the religious edifices. They destroyed temples. But they didn't much mess with the socio-political system of administration. That the previous system was still existing the way it was. But when the British came, they tried to homogenize everything. Because they wanted one legal system for the whole country. And because they wanted one legal system, they said, okay, you are Hindus, we will govern you according to your principles. It didn't always happen like that. But that's what they claimed. But because the Vedic path was so diverse, there was no like one absolute principle for everywhere. Because there is regional diversity. So it was when they tried to consolidate or they tried to homogenize everything, that's when certain negativity started getting highlighted. So because what happens is, anybody who forms laws, anybody who gives rules, the rules are important. But there are rules which are like guidelines and there are rules which are to-dos. Like the road may say, go this way. And that's the map on the road, this is the road. But at the ground level, the road, there might be some repair work going on. You know, there might be some oil spilled over there. So at the ground level when you go, don't go this way. So my map may be given by the government. And the government is saying, go this way. But there is a sign on the road, you're saying, don't go this way. So whom am I to follow? Well, both are coming from the government. Both are coming from authority. The point is, we cannot just have a global authority for everything. There has to be local authority. So this acceptance of there are universal principles, but specific applications of those principles, this was lost when the British tried to homogenize everything. And that's when many of the negativity that were associated with Hinduism, they started coming up. So, dowry as a socially imposed system or sati as something just socially imposed, that was never there. It was only when the British said this is outlawed, then some Hindus started saying this has to be, this is our practice. How dare you encroach on our rights? No, it was nothing like that. We see in the Mahabharata, in the Ramayana, it is not the queens go sati after Dashrath Maharaj passes away. In the Mahabharata, it is Kunti doesn't go sati after Pandu passes away. Or even before that, when Satyavati is still living after Shantanu departs. So, this was not imposed. But when this was said, you cannot do it, that's when some people said, how dare you stop us from doing this? This is our practice. And they started imposing it more and more. Now again, this is simplified history and I don't want to demonize the British over here. I'm talking about a broad principle over here. So, historically, when the Brahmanas and Kshatriyas, their jurisdiction was not separated, then what happens is, one is, the Brahmanas try to dominate the Kshatriyas, And the other is the Brahmanas completely separate from the Kshatriyas. So secularism, in some ways, so secularism also has its history. And historian, political philosophers, they say, secularism was originally meant to be neutrality toward religion. Okay, you want to follow this, you follow this. But from there, it went down to apathy toward religion. Neutrality means this, that is okay. Whatever you want, you do. Apathy means we don't care for it at all. And from apathy, now in many places, it has gone to antipathy. Antipathy means hostility, opposition to religion. Now, the world is a complex place. In some places there are theocratic states where actually the state mandates religion. And this leads to disaster. I mean, we often talk about Islamic extremism and that causes a lot of problems. Well, that is true. But it is also true that the biggest victims of Islamic extremism are Muslims. Shia-Sunni fights are huge. And states are at war in the Middle East, and they have been at war in the Middle East, because when the state starts mandating a religion, then the conflicts become escalated far, far more. There are religious differences, but when the religious differences become politicalized, or politics is used to exploit religious differences, then things become far worse. So this, you could say, again, this is the extreme. One extreme of the pendulum was the state imposing religion. That we don't want. The state imposing religion. Religion means specific codes. This that led to problems. And the state now opposing religion. Now what do you mean by opposing religion? Is the state actually opposing religion anywhere? Well, yes and no. In communism, the state was very explicitly opposing religion. Religion was very strongly being persecuted. And communism had the idea that we want to do good to the world. Prabhupada uses the word welfare state in his purport. Now, Prabhupada often uses contemporary vocabulary, but to convey a higher principle. So welfare state is a typical leftist word. We want a welfare state. But Prabhupada says, what is, Prabhupada uses that term, but then he expands the definition of what is welfare. So, this happened that the state was, both of these extremes are to be avoided. Now, how do we work? Now, if you consider, state starts to impose, if they don't impose religion specifically, they may try to impose a particular practice which they think is to be good. And this is why earlier, the dharma, I said, it can have two meanings. Dharma, first of all, is not bhakti. But dharma can mean ethics, or dharma can mean law and order. So here in the Dharma Shastra, there's a huge discussion on the relationship between the moral and the legal. What is the relationship? Should everything immoral be made illegal? Should everything that is immoral, that is considered wrong, say for example, should everything immoral be made illegal? Should the law be used to impose morality? We say yes. Otherwise, how will there be morality? Well, it's not that simple. When America, generally we think of America as a materialistic country. But actually, in the westernized part of the world, America is the most religious country. As compared to UK or France or Australia, America, at least one part of America, southern part of America, is highly religious, evangelical. So, when the evangelicals were in power, in America, they tried to impose a religious principle on society. And that was called, they tried to impose no intoxication. And they tried to, that is called abolition. And what was the result of that? No intoxication when they tried to implement? Let me say alcohol is bad. But the result was twofold. The whole alcohol industry became underground and illegal. People were still wanted to drink, and people were trying to find ways in which they would drink. And then, as this became underground and illegal, the government became more corrupt. Because what happens is, the authorities know something is happening, and they wink an eye at it. They let it happen. So, in this way, in general, what happens is in the state, when there is state overreach, then these two things happen. If some people have certain immoral tendencies, they will simply do it illegally. And then actually the state's power increases further because the corruption increases further. Because they find loopholes to get, keep doing it. And similarly, now in today's world, abortion is an extremely, extremely volatile issue. So in America, those who were pro-choice campaigners, they pro-choice, those who want abortion, they realized that in general America was religious and they could not get abortion to be legalized. So they choose the, not the political way, but the legal way. They appealed to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court said that abortion is a right of every human being. And then when this happened, Roe v. Wade was the case by which abortion was made as a right. And that was there for 30-35 years. And recently, the Roe v. Wade, that case was, decision was reversed by in America. So now, this does not mean abortion has become illegal. What they said is, see, India is a federation. America is a confederation. Federation means the center has power and the center gives power to the states. Whereas confederation means the states have power and the states give power to the center. So, America, what they decided is that now every state will decide its own policy about abortion. So, every state, the legislative assembly will either vote or they will have their own decisions. Now, what has happened because of this is that certain states, especially those which are Christian states, they have banned all abortion. Now, in one sense, abortion, ethically speaking, yes, there is killing of life over there. And that should be avoided. But the problem with mandating an absolute rule like that is that the whole thing becomes illegal. So, in all the neighborhoods of the Republican states, which are primarily pro-life, in the neighborhood, in the last 6 months, like a huge amount of abortion industry has flourished just outside the state boundary. And then, now, another thing that is happening is, okay, if women cannot have abortion, there has been an increased demand for male vasectomy. That men should be, they should do surgery by which they will not impregnate a woman. So now, if the real life concern is not addressed, generally when a top-down measure is imposed, now I'm not saying abortion should not be, I'm not making a stand here on how politically abortion should be dealt with. Because when there is a need, now we may say that, is it, the way it is portrayed is the left will, people portray those who support abortion, they hate babies. You're killing babies. And the way is those who oppose abortion, it says you hate women. You know, you want to control women, you want to control what a woman is doing. Well, it's not controlling women because it's the future of humanity that is a matter of concern. But it's not that anyone hates babies. It's just that in today's world where people are living in isolated families, taking care of children is not easy. So what is to be done? In general, in the history of the world, policies that have been implemented top-down, they have almost always backfired. Especially something is imposed, there's a difference between imposing and educating or inspiring. So abolition was imposed. That means no liquor available. But imposition, it doesn't fire, it backfires. So we can contrast this in today's world with, say, in the Indian government, we are celebrating the National Yoga Day. So it's not that every Indian citizen is told you have to practice yoga. It's not a government rule. But the very fact that the head of the state and the government is promoting this, is inspiring this, is facilitating this, is encouraging it, that has a tremendous effect. The yoga was already quite big in the Western world, but after it has received a fillip at the national state level, but the fillip was not so much imposition as inspiration. So this is, even the Kshatriyas, when it comes to matters of personal habits, they cannot impose, they have to inspire. Of course, now the challenge over here is, so the second point was I talking about how some things have worked, some things have not worked. So I'll conclude the last point now, that what can we do, what is doable for us? If tomorrow some politician becomes spiritually inclined or spiritually inspired, then they say, I would like to implement some spiritual wisdom from the Bhagavad Gita in my political policies. What are we going to tell them? So it's not so simple. Can we tell them, yes, you get all government employees to chant Hare Krishna? Well, that is not going to fly in today's world. No, there will be immediate backlash against it. So there are specific practices and there are universal values. So the values can be inspired. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, I long for the day when the judges in the Indian government will be wearing tilak. Now, when he says this, what does he mean? We look at the history of India. The British always kept the top judges from among their own ranks. The lower level judges were from Indians. Bhaktivinoda Thakur rose remarkably to a high level. So this kind of thing, judges being devotees. Wearing tilak means what? The judges are devotees. They are practicing bhakti. And their practice of bhakti is not seen as a disqualification. So how could this happen? There are two ways. There's a top-down approach. And then there is a bottom-up approach. So top-down approach means, say, a devotee becomes a king. And a devotee decides, I want to reform the judicial system and I'll appoint other devotees as judges. Well, okay, that's one way. It could work, but for it to work, something else has to work. Actually, those who are appointed as judges have to be not just good devotees, but good judges. If they are not professionally competent, they can make a huge mess of things. In the world, managing the world is a complicated thing. And if you impose by fiat something, it can backfire. Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself actually demonstrates this trajectory. He was working in the British government, but he himself, by his personal competence, rose to a level where he was appointed by the judge, and he was appointed a judge, and he was respected by the British government. So the idea is, this bottom-up way of influence is what is more doable and more sustainable. So it is, there is this, with respect to politicians, there are two exceptions. There is we demonize politicians. Politicians do this and politicians do that. And it's almost like for many people, politicians are like their favorite whipping boys. They do this, low down, this politician is terrible, that politician is terrible. And that to the extent people do this, they go to the other extreme. And they romanticize it. Romanticize means people start thinking, there is one political leader who will come. And he will be a strong political leader. And what does a strong idea mean? He will do what I want everybody to do. That's the idea of a strong political leader. And he will save the whole world. Well, this is the Masiha complex. This is not a part of the Vedic tradition. This is the Abrahamic religions constantly waiting for someone to come to save the world. So nowadays, in today's world, in many ways, politics has become the replacement for religion. And that is why political conflicts become very bitter at times. Political leaders are sometimes idolized as if they are God. They are not God. They cannot be God. In America especially, America is almost like two countries. There are two political parties and the lines are very almost clear in many places. And especially when the previous president was there, families, brothers stop talking with brothers, parents stop talking with children, friends stop talking with friends, not only stop talking, like start fighting. You voted for this person, how could you vote for such a person? So, this is almost like religious fights. You go to that church, you worship this God, I can't talk with you anymore. So politics has become the surrogate religion. But politics is not going to save the world. Yes, politics is one part and it's important. But actually, every area of life is important. And what
is what will balance understanding is not demonize, not romanticize, but utilize. Utilize means what? That if for sharing spiritual education, for sharing spiritual values, if the state becomes a little more supportive, the state becomes a little more appreciative, not imposing. Say for example, the Bhagavad Gita can be taught as a religious book. Or the Bhagavad Gita can be taught as a book of wisdom, as a book of values. And as a book of values, if the government becomes more supportive, the government becomes more favorable, then the Gita's wisdom can be spread. You know, we, through our individual initiatives, can spread to some extent. But if the government, does the government have to adopt the Gita as a national book? See, there are symbolic gestures and there are transformative actions. Sometimes when we emphasize symbolic gestures, then people start fighting over those gestures itself. And no transformation happens. So, transformative actions are more important than symbolic gestures. That, what is more important is that, if the government in some way starts supporting some spiritual practice, or some spiritual practices, some spiritual principles, that can elevate human consciousness, then that is what will lead to politics also being utilized for raising human consciousness. And that means that the Brahmanas and Kshatriyas will have to work together. I'll conclude with this point, I'll conclude with the last point. The Catholic Church is actually very influential in this. They have their Catholic theologians, which are more like, now rough approximation, they are like the forest sages. And then they have specific think tanks. So they have think tanks for, say, abolition, think tank for adoption, think tank for a particular thing. So these are scholars who study that particular issue very deeply. Say for example, now there are test tube babies and genetics has become a huge ethical issue. And there's a lot of discussion going on. What can be done? Can stem cell research be done or not? All those questions. So there are specific bodies for that. Think tanks devoted to specific issues. So think tanks are more like the city brass sages. They are aware of the complexity of the issue. And then they give some policy guidelines. So we as a movement, right now, our temples may be in the cities. But our Brahmanas are more like forest sages right now. You know, what is the advice we give? Oh, actually you're not the body or the soul. Okay, that's fine. But what does that mean for policy? What is to be implemented? So as our movement evolves, we will need to have specific think tanks, which will study and address specific issues. And that's how the Brahmanas can tangibly guide the state. So there could be a top-down approach, but that will have to be a specialized top-down approach. But more effective is the bottom-up approach. So the top-down approach means the Brahmanas guide the Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas implement. So this will require specific think tanks, where they understand the complexity, understand what is doable and what can be done. And the bottom-up would be the Kshatriyas, they facilitate general spiritual principles. They facilitate spirituality in some way that is appropriate. So in this way, like in every other field, like just as any other field can be used for spiritualization of consciousness, even politics can also be used for spiritualizing consciousness. So I'll summarize. I spoke 3 points today, just to quickly repeat. The first point was the principles of the interaction between Brahmanas and Kshatriyas. That first, there is a separation of power, the recognition of different specializations. And how does the interaction happen? The city Brahmanas, they give more practical guidance, but the danger is they can become docile because they are controlled and they can be threatened by the Kshatriyas. The forest sages, they can give more independent guidance, but they can be irrelevant. So it is the Kshatriya who decides which advice to follow and how to implement. So the Brahmanas don't think I am Kshatriya or I can constantly control a Kshatriya. The Kshatriyas have Ishwar Bhava. The Brahmana should not be having that. And then we discussed about the history, how things happened. So secularism was a reaction to religious overreach. So the Catholic Church became like the super state. And when Protestantism came, they reacted against it. But then the Protestant states were also just as religious
And that led to the war. So then the secularism was an expression of political humility. That the state will not mandate what people believe. Now this problem was not there in the Vedic tradition, because there's a difference between dharma and bhakti. Bhakti was to be inspired. Dharma is to be implemented. So dharma can mean ethics, but more specifically it means law and order. Because even ethics cannot always be implemented. We discussed the difference between that not everything illegal can, everything immoral can't be made illegal. So if we just rule out, we make alcohol consumption illegal, it only leads to the illegal business flourishing and the government authorities become more corrupt. So what is doable in today's world? So we talked about principles, then we talked about history, and we talked about practices possible today. So the bottom-up and the top-down approach, Bhaktivinoda Thakur demonstrates the success of the bottom-up approach. That by his competence, he rose to a respectable position. So as devotees in different professions become competent, and then the politicians will be happy to appoint devotees because they are competent, not because they are devotees. And then for the bottom-up approach, if the political leaders could just support spiritual principles, facilitate, not impose, facilitate in the state's infrastructure, can be used not necessarily to impose spiritual practices, but to inspire universal spiritual values. And if we have our version of city brahmanas, that means we have dedicated think tanks associated with specific issues, then they can provide realistic, grounded inputs that then the political leaders can eventually implement that. In this way, we see politics not to be demonized as the source of all evil, not to be romanticized as the arena where some savior king or savior head of state will appear and save. Rather, politics is one area among various areas through which we can endeavor to raise human consciousness. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, Krishna Prabhu.
Thank you, Prabhuji, for the very nice class. So I just wanted to understand, given the fact that Brahmanas have a particular role to play in society and the Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Shudras. Now, Brahmanas are the ones who are the twice born, right? So they get the Brahman thread and then, they are continuously expected to exhibit the qualities of a Brahmana. Like you get the example of a Pope, who's actually supposed to be a Brahmana, but then, he takes on a managerial role also, which was a dichotomy. But in our context of ISKCON, I just wanted to understand that we have our first initiation, our Inam initiation, and then we have a second initiation. Now, at the time of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I was told that Srila Prabhupada, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, would give Brahman initiation only to those who were directly doing deity worship. But during Srila Prabhupada's time, we found that Brahman initiation is being given even to those who are exhibiting qualities of Kshatriya, Vaishya or even Shudra. So then, I'm trying to correlate what you said with what is presently happening in ISKCON, that devotees are thinking that by taking Brahman Diksha, they are actually becoming Brahmanas in the true sense of the term. So is that what really is the intention behind giving the second initiation? Or are we to understand that actually second initiation is meant only for those who are exhibiting a quality of a Brahmana?
Okay.
In the ISKCON context.
Okay. So our Brahmana is, what is the role of Brahman initiation? So within our movement, well, I cannot answer this question because I am not a forest sage. I am a city sage. I am not a sage at all. But, okay, I'll talk about three broad points. I won't give any decision or wording, but I'll just give some pointers for thought. See, there's a, within our philosophy, or within how this philosophy is applied, there is a constant ongoing tension between the spiritual perspective and the material perspective. What do I mean that? From the spiritual perspective, the Vaishnava is far above Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya and Shudra. So this is the hierarchy. The Vaishnava is far above this. This is the understanding. Because the Vaishnava knows the ultimate purpose of life and is dedicated to the purpose of life. At the same time, sometimes when you use the word material perspective, material is not wrong. Material is not ignorant. The material perspective is also important. And from a functional perspective, it may be extremely important. And when I go to America, I go there to share spiritual knowledge. But at the immigration, when they ask, where have you come from? I can't say I'm a soul who has come. You know, I have to tell my country where I have come from, isn't it? So from a functional perspective, the material vision is also important. So within the material perspective, what happens is, these are four different varnas, and everybody is born with a particular nature. Everybody is born with a particular nature. So this is from Purva Janma. Now, can one's swabhava, can one's varna be changed? That is a big question. So, now, of course, now if you go into Chanakya's writings, but other places also. Now, in Indian history, there are two schools of thought. That this is something similar to what is called as a nature-nurture debate. That means, what determines how a child grows up? Is it the child has their own nature or is it the parenting that shapes it? So when you talk about swabhava, there have been two schools of thought. One is the swabhava is determined by birth. Everybody has a swabhava from birth and that is what their swabhava is going to be. Whereas upbringing shapes the swabhava of a person. That is another understanding. And now, of course, birth affects and upbringing also affects. But the idea is the birth is the greater factor or the greatest factor. Whereas the other idea is that the upbringing is the greatest factor. The way a person is raised, the way a person conducts themselves, the way the kind of training a person receives, the kind of atmosphere a person lives in. So that shapes who a person becomes. So now, if we stick to the traditional perspective that that is not the only traditional perspective, the one traditional perspective, that birth is the primary determiner of swabhava because our Purva Janma karma determines it. Then there is no question of changing varna. From that perspective, the idea of a Brahman Diksha becomes absurd, to use a strong word for it. Because how can somebody become a Brahmana when everybody has their varna by birth? So, now the other perspective is, yes, we have our birth, but our qualities are shaped much more by our upbringing than by our present life's actions and situations. They shape our nature and character much more than our past. And in general, so the Gita seems to emphasize the birth. That's why Krishna tells repeatedly that Arjuna says, Swabhava jena kaunte nibaddha svena karmana. That Arjuna, you have the Swabhava Kshatriya, that is how you should act. Now, of course, it's not that simple. Because in the case of Arjuna, it's also indicated that he had lived his life as a Kshatriya throughout. But the idea that Swabhava is what is... Now, I'm not saying that Swabhava is determined by birth. I'm not saying that by that means anybody born in Brahmana family is a Brahmana. That's a separate thing. Okay, this is becoming a little complicated. See, that sometimes in a Kshatriya family, a child may be born who has a Brahmana nature. But that nature was acquired by the Purva Karma from this life. So when I say Swabhava is determined by birth, I'm not saying the family in which the child is born, that determines the Swabhava of the child. I'm saying that the Purva Janma Karma has brought that soul to a particular point and the soul has a particular Swabhava. So Prabhupada in general emphasized the upbringing part. And when Srila Prabhupada made Brahman Diksha, or he made it like a significant rite, a ceremony within the Krishna conscious movement, you know. So, Brahman Diksha, is it more of a social designation or is it more of a personal character or personal character marker? That means, what do you mean personal character marker? See, Srila Prabhupada, more than Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur, he faced the challenge of having people who were outside the Vedic Dharma, in a conventional sense, that people who were considered Nechas and Yavanas, they had started practicing bhakti. And they were going to worship in the temple also. So the tradition would not have accepted that. Not necessarily Gaudiya tradition, but the broader Vedic tradition would not have accepted that. They are not born in a Brahmana family. How can they worship the deities? So from a functional requirement, we needed, like you said, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur also had Brahmanas. Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur also was very ecumenical, very inclusive. He initiated non-Brahmanas also. And he initiated non-Brahmanas, not just Harinam Diksha, but when they were doing deity worship, especially deity worship, so they were required to be Brahman initiated. That was a conventional understanding that if you're not a Brahmana, how can you worship the deities? So Prabhupada also, in his temples, practically in the first decade, there were no Indians. So all the temples were run by Westerners. So then he had to initiate them. So the Brahman Diksha was more of a social designation that, you know, these people, they are worshipping the deities and they are not non-Brahmanas worshipping the deities, they are Brahmanas. They have been given Brahman initiation. Now, there are a few passages where Prabhupada said only the first initiation is necessary. Neither the second nor the third. Third is sannyasa initiation. Second and third are not necessary for one's spiritual growth or for one to attain the spiritual world. Having said that, you can't just have people designated as Brahmanas, or if they have got Brahman Diksha, so they are going to pre-worship the deities. They should also have some Brahmanical qualities. And that is why when we talk about Brahman Diksha, we emphasize Brahmanical qualities. But is it that everybody, if we just simply see it like a trajectory of spiritual growth, then you have taken first initiation, when are you going to take second initiation? If you start portraying it like that, then is it that everybody who is going to take Brahman Diksha will have the disposition of a Brahmana? Well, unlikely. Unlikely. It is not only unlikely, it may not even be essential. Because in our movement, we also need people who are expert in other fields, who can also execute the services required in those fields. So, Brahman Diksha is, in one sense, if you consider Vaishnavism is higher than a Brahmana also, in principle, then what does it mean in terms of spiritual purpose? Vaishnava is very clear. A Brahmana may not be also very clear of the spiritual purpose. If you see in the qualities of a Brahmana that are described in the Bhagavad Gita, Shamo Damastapa Shaucham, bhakti is not mentioned as a quality of a Brahmana. Because a Brahmana, that is one's own faith. You cannot mandate that. So, Shamo Damastapa, it's to be intellectual. They are priests, they are teachers, they are scholars. That's what is described, focus on them. But bhakti, does that mean the Brahmanas are abhaktas? Not exactly. But that is not a mandatory quality. The Shukracharya is considered to be a Brahmana. Although he is serving the demons. He is the priest of the demons. And he is respected as a priest of the demons. So, within our movement, as I started by talking about the material and spiritual perspectives being different. So, from a spiritual perspective, we can say that every devotee is actually, they are seriously practicing bhakti, they are more than a Brahmana. From the material perspective, we can have both ideas. That, you know, everybody has their nature and that nature doesn't change. And just giving a Brahman Diksha is not going to change their nature. If we are proponents more of the Swabhava by birth idea, Now, if you consider Swabhava by upbringing idea, then we can say that the practice of bhakti, actually just chanting 16 rounds japa, that requires a significant level of sattva-guna. It's, unless a person has certain level of brahminical qualities, it's going to be very, very difficult to do that. It's not that others can't do it, but it's tough. So, I'm not saying that everybody chants 16 rounds has to be a brahmana. But the point is that brahminical qualities do develop to some extent by the practices of bhakti as are described by Srila Prabhupada, even for first initiation. So, in that sense, through upbringing, many brahminical qualities may manifest. But, so I'll conclude with two things. First is that it is not that every devotee should feel pressured that I have to take second initiation. If they, their conscience tells them, you know, I'm not exactly living like a brahmana, and therefore I don't want to take this initiation. So they should not feel individually or socially pressured to take second initiation. The second is that those who are taking second initiation, they should not feel pressured to give up their varnik seva. That if somebody is very good at fundraising, if somebody is very good at management, just because they're second initiation, does that mean they all have to become Shastric scholars and Shastric teachers? Not necessarily. They see it as, yes, this is a part of my spiritual trajectory for spiritual growth. But maybe I will be a fundraiser, I'll be a manager, but let me try to increase a little bit sattva guna in my life. How can I do it in less rajasic way? And that is something which we all can do. That's how Brahman Diksha can be understood in our moment. That's my small understanding. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, we are way over time now. Can we talk one to one? So, thank you very much. Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jai Gaur Premanande.